Thank you for joining us on Full Logic Reverse. I'm your host, Mike Thornton, and today our guest is author Jennifer Toth, discussing her book, Orphans of the Living. Jennifer, thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thank you.
Well, I certainly appreciate it. Can you talk about your newest book, Orphans of the Living? It sounds tremendously interesting.
Oh, thank you. Actually, it came out of the Mole People, because when I was doing Mole People, which is about the homeless in the tunnels under New York City, I found that a lot of the young people in the tunnels and in the soup kitchens were either running away from foster care or who had recently aged out of the system. And I found the stories that they told me about what was going on in foster care was very different from what I thought I knew of foster care. So I wanted to find out what was happening, why these kids were sort of gravitating to the fringe of society rather than becoming part of society. And I wanted to find out from them. So I chose 5 kids across the country and to learn what foster care was through their eyes and their experiences. Each of the kids are from different parts of the country. There's Angel from Los Angeles, who went through 19 placements and 4 caseworkers in 2 years. And she finally escaped the system at age 14 by marrying her 69-year-old foster father. And she did that with the permission of her mother, the written permission of her mother, who had been through foster care and realized how destructive the system was on her life. So she thought anything was better for her daughter. And if that meant marrying her foster father, that was the best solution. Angel is very attractive, and she's always trying to make herself look older because she looks so young and fresh. But she's now 19, and she has 5 kids, and 4 of them are in foster care, so they're now third generation foster care. Then there's Brian in Chicago. Brian says his best foster placement in his first 14 years was a prison. He had been in a kinship care foster home and in and out of juvenile detention facilities before a judge finally sent him to prison. And that's where he said he finally learned respect and discipline and a sense of values. So he said that was his best foster placement in his young life. And then with the help of an extraordinary caseworker and an extraordinary children's home, he went on to college, and he's now a junior at Chicago State University, and he hopes to go into social work and reform the system.
Jennifer, let me stop you for just a second, because I'm sitting here listening to what you're saying, and I mean, just in these first 2 examples, we have a 14-year-old girl who finds herself in such a horrendous system that escape, a viable avenue of escape, is marrying her 69-year-old foster parent. And mother, who has been through the system, sees this as being a good idea. And in the next example you give us, we have a young man who's saying that the best foster placement he had was a prison. I mean, that just in that, those 2 stories, this is a tremendous indictment on the foster care system in this country. At least it seems that way to me.
Oh, it is. I mean, I think that the foster care system is failing these kids. And I watched a lot of kids self-destruct in the system and actually be destroyed in the system. I mean, while there are some very good and selfless foster parents out there and some extraordinary caseworkers and children's home, I think that they're the exception, and I think they have to spend too much of their time fighting the system to do what's right for the kids rather than being helped by the system to help these kids.
Talk, if you will, a little bit more about some of the kids that you've seen destroyed in this system.
Well, there's Damien and Sebastian in North Carolina who go into a North Carolina children's home. Damien comes into the system because of neglect. And he's joined by his 5 brothers and sisters. And nowhere in his files do they say anything about the abuse that he experienced in his biological home. And so within a year, he starts acting out that abuse on other children in the home. He rapes 2 younger boys. He threatens another one with a butcher knife before he's kicked out of that home, the children's home, put in an emergency shelter where he rapes a 3rd boy and is finally given therapy and put into a psychiatric hospital for help. And along the way, he crashes into Sebastian. And Sebastian comes to the home, a very intelligent, good-looking boy, I thought he had a really good chance to succeed. And one of the counselors said his worst problem was that he wanted to please too much. And that's a pretty good problem for a kid to have, I think. But he gets picked on in the regular hazing routine in many of these children's homes have. I mean, sometimes they have sort of more of a Lord of the Flies type atmosphere than a regular home-like environment. And he tries to show his bravado by being aggressive. And he warns his therapist and other people in the home that he has these violent, bloody dreams and that when he wakes up he feels good. And he worries about his lack of remorse. And Sebastian is basically a walking time bomb. He goes on for about a year trying to fight these impulses before he finally acts out violently and is put into prison.
We're talking with author Jennifer Toth, author of the books Orphans of the Living and The Mole People. Jennifer, I'm just sitting here listening to you speak, and I'm saying to myself, this is tremendously sad, what's happening to these young people.
Right, it is. It's tragic. But I think one of the most important things that these kids taught me is that they're not tragic. I found a lot of hope in them. I found a lot of resilience. And in fact, I had come away from my first book, The Mole People, feeling very depressed about the homeless and the tunnels. Most of their lives were over. And I wanted to look into the foster care system and see, you know, where can we change this? Where can we save these people so that they don't grow up to live in tunnels? Or, you know, statistics show that 40% of the kids in foster care go on to welfare or to prison. And, you know, and this is the perfect opportunity to break that cycle, to help these kids become productive and happy members of society. And when I, you know, even Damien and Sebastian, they were crying out for help along the way before they self-destructed. You know, there was so many opportunities to help them. And they were so open to many of these opportunities that if we had just been there for them a little bit, I think they could have been saved. So I actually found it a very hopeful topic. In fact, most of the times I spent with the kids, they had me laughing and enjoying life because that's who they are. And what they've been through is tragic, but they themselves are wonderful people.
You talked about the good people in the system, the ones who were really making an effort to try and help these children, having to battle the system in order to do that. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. I was really amazed that there were people. It's such a closed system, the foster care system. And in fact, I think most of this stuff is going on because it's so closed and the public doesn't know about it. Public doesn't know that kids are being raped in children's homes or in orphanages. They don't know that there are orphanages that aren't inspected or licensed by the state and that kids still get paddled. And these things wouldn't be going on if the public knew about it. And they don't know about it because of these so-called child privacy laws, which were put into effect to protect the children from public exposure, but really protect a system that's crumbling, and it's protecting the workers who are not helping the children, but helping to destroy them. So I found that there were people who were really risking their jobs, their careers, I mean, risking everything to come forward and tell me the truth of what was going on in these placements. I mean, there were people who had spent 30 years in the system trying to help these kids who would tell me about how they had over-medicated children to the point where they drooled and couldn't remember their names, and for some of those kids, those drugs weren't prescribed, but they had just been tired of watching the kids. Those kinds of things. They really put themselves in jeopardy by telling me those things, but they did it because they finally felt it was time to really change the system and help these kids. Right? Children's Home Director Mike Alston was a person who really came forward. I mean, that wasn't one of the abuses in his home, but he really came forward to talk very openly about what was going on in foster care so it would change. And then, you know, there are a lot of people who were really more afraid of how they might come across than worried about the welfare of the children. And I thought that was pretty sad, that the system is more determined to protect itself than it is to protect the children and help the children.
We're talking with author Jennifer Toth, author of the books Orphans of the Living and The Mole People. Jennifer, it would seem to me that some people in authority would and should take notice of what you have exposed in this book. Can you talk if anything has happened as a result of that? I mean, did you go to some of the bureaucrats that run these systems and say, hey, look what's going on here?
My primary mission in this book was to bring these kids' stories to life for the public and for everybody to see what was going on. I'm afraid that a lot of people in the system know about these things. A lot of caseworkers have come upon them themselves. But to bring it up to another level so that policymakers, politicians, and the general public knows what's going on, that's really what I want to do. I really want to bring these kids back into the mainstream and bring them to life. And there are over half a million kids in the system going through these kinds of things. And, you know, so few people really know about what their lives are like. And these kids are growing up stigmatized and feeling not a part of society. So I really hope it does bring about some change. I think it's really necessary. I mean, a lot of the things I found I thought were really Dickensian. I could not believe that they were going on today. And I hope that it does help stop these things from happening. Jamie is a beautiful young woman. She's blonde hair and green eyes. And she's also in North Carolina. She's from Lumberton, North Carolina. And when I walk down the street with her, a lot of people turn to look at her because she's so attractive. She's really a striking young woman. And she thinks they're looking at her because they sense there's something wrong with her, that something's missing, that she grew up in an orphanage. She thinks it's that apparent. That kind of feeling I found was very common among the kids. Jamie felt that way. Angel felt that way. And Brian, he felt that way. In fact, in college, he took a course called Family because he wanted to learn what a family was because he'd never been a part of a healthy family. But Jamie is an extraordinary young woman. She was put into a strict religious orphanage in South Carolina where she and the other kids were taught that they were there to pay for the sins of their parents. She did very well there, actually, and there were a lot of people who wanted to adopt her, but she really didn't want to be adopted. She loves her mother and her extended family, her aunts. She didn't want to be separated from them officially. She eventually gets kicked out of that children's home for standing up for a girl who's being told that she's in that orphanage, that her parents were killed in a car wreck because of her sins. And she stands up for this girl, and she gets kicked out of the orphanage, and she gets put into state foster care. She goes into a children's home in North Carolina and does very well there. She goes from failing school when she's with her mother to a straight-A student in this children's home, and she becomes the first child in that children's home 200-year history to go on to college. So she's now at North Carolina State University, and she's working full-time trying to get through school, and she hopes to go into become a lawyer or a journalist.
So despite all the obstacles, it seems that there are at least some of these children who can persevere through maintaining that spirit and hope that you talked about earlier.
That's right. That's right. Jamie has that resilience that's so important in these kids. And I think one of the reasons that she was able to succeed was because her aunts and her extended family really does care. They do care about her, and they look in on her. And they would check in on her in the children's home, make sure things were going okay. For Damien and Sebastian, for example, there was no one to look in on them. There was no one to be their advocate, and there was no one to make them feel loved. And I found that the kids who at some point had been loved or remembered being loved, they somehow felt worthy of success and were more determined to succeed. Brian, for example, had been through some terrible foster placements. At one point, he was in a two-bedroom house with 13 kids, and he didn't have enough food to eat, sometimes a bed to sleep in. That was in foster care. But he had watched his mother die of a drug overdose when he was 7. But before she died, he really felt her love, and his older sister, Crystal, had taken care of him before they were separated in foster care. So he knew that there was something worthy inside of him. A lot of these kids don't have that. I mean, I've seen 9-year-olds who've tried to commit suicide, not simply because nobody loves them, but because they feel that there's something so deeply wrong with them and unlovable about them, and that life is too hard to survive, you know, to live without any kind of love. I think that the greatest thing that I learned in this book was not just about the abuses that go on in foster care. I mean, they're horrifying and they're shocking and they're sort of interesting in their own way. But I was just amazed at how wonderful these kids are and how courageous they were to come forward with the truth of foster care, not only when they had been wronged by the system or by their parents, but when they had chosen the wrong path. And I think by telling the whole truth of things they might have done wrong, as well as their parents and the system, we can come to understand them in a better way and maybe help the next generation of kids going through the system. I think what they've done is very courageous and very important. And in fact, all of the kids wanted their real names to be used so that people would know that their stories are true and real, and there'd be no doubt that what happened to them really happened. And for Jamie, Angel, and Brian, I did use their real names. But for Damien and Sebastian, I changed their names because I felt they were too young to make that decision, and they were not only the victims of rape and violence, but they later turned to rape and abuse other kids.
It seems that in addition to listening to what these young people have to say about the system that they know so intimately, that it would be a really good idea for the public to really put some very, very intense scrutiny on what's happening, or else I think we'll all have a tremendous price to pay in the future.
Yes, I think so. I hope so. I hope they do read it.
Jennifer, can you let people know who publishes the books?
Sure. Simon & Schuster published Orphans of the Living, Stories of America's Children in Foster Care. And The Mole People, Life in the Tunnels Beneath New York City, is published by Chicago Review Press.
Jennifer Toth, author of the books Orphans of the Living and The Mole People, thank you for being with us today on Full Logic Reverse.
Thank you very much.